Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is author Charles Martin. Charles and I will be discussing about his latest novel, titled Provocative. The book explores the human experience that surrounds the age-old contest between men and women, alpha males meeting their match in an audacious young woman as she confronts powerful men in the intriguing high-life world of CEOs, yachting, and cybercrime. Good morning, Charles. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny.
Wonderful. I'm excited to have you on the show this morning. Provocative is a wonderful read. The storyline is powerful, sophisticated, and thrilling, and it's also beautifully written. So, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, Johnny, I'm a very healthy but 75-year-old man, and I've had a very active life, so I'll try and be brief so as not to take up all your time with this part question. I was born in a small town in Ohio to very poor parents. But they were very loving parents with good values and strong work ethic. I graduated from Ohio State University in 1960. I worked my way through college because my folks were too poor to help me. I worked 40 to 45 hours a week while carrying a minimum academic load of 21 units. So I was a very busy guy during college. I graduated with 5 majors, a 310-unit bachelor's degree. So early on, I had this voracious appetite to learn. It's something that's been with me all through my life. When I graduated from college, my first job out of college was in California, actually working for Howard Hughes and his Hughes Electronics business. A few years later, did a high-tech startup when I was very young, 24 years old. Had an operating career running companies, then eventually started a venture capital firm that became the largest in Southern California. We backed over 100 companies during the course of that. And in parallel with that, I started a private equity leveraged buyout firm that would buy about 25 companies over its history. Both were hugely successful. I retired from the venture capital firm in 1999 and from the leveraged buyout firm in 2001. Since then, I did start a hedge fund. I run a hedge fund now, which is a great deal of it is my own money, but I'm very, very involved in philanthropic type of activities, mainly focused on higher education and the arts. I serve as a trustee of 2 universities, one of an outstanding private university, Chapman, and the other one, a top public university, the University of California at Irvine. That's a really brief rundown.
With all this time that you are so busy doing all kinds of things, when did you discover your love to write?
Well, I think writing has been an interest of mine all through my life, but it's mostly been on nonfiction type of subjects. I've written very, very extensive white papers, essays on things that related to investment strategy, global public policy, things of a more esoteric nature. So, and I did write 2 prior books, one on investment and one on my sailing adventures when I was a young man in my 20s and 30s. But this move into fiction has been really, really great fun.
That's wonderful to know. Do you have any favorite authors that inspire you?
You know, I read a lot, but I have read very little fiction, oddly enough. But certainly one that comes to mind is McMurtry. Reading The Lonesome Dove, it's just like a great painting. I mean, it's marvelous what a great writer can do with words on paper.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Robert Duvall did an excellent job in that.
Yes, yes, absolutely he did. Yes, he did. He was perfectly cast for that role.
Do you use your writing as an escape to express yourself, since you've written a lot of white papers in a public forum, or just to entertain others?
You know, actually, I write for my own creative pleasure, not really for others, mm-hmm. you know, which is, you know, it's a little different than many authors who have to depend on it for their income.
Yeah.
I don't. I've been very, very fortunate to, you know, get ahead in life economically. So I write for, you know, for just the creative pleasure of it.
Very interesting. What life experiences influence your writing most?
I guess mostly it's just observing people, you know, mm-hmm. and mostly I'm very fascinated by the interaction between men and women. I think it's one of the more interesting aspects of life, actually.
Mm-hmm. What inspires you about Provocative? What got you to write that wonderful novel? Because when I read it, there's a lot of passion from you in terms of the writing aspects of it, and you're very thorough, very detailed. The book has a tremendous amount of things that only I would consider someone on the inside would know.
Well, at my age, there's been a lot of the river of life that's run under my bridge, so to speak. And this was just I didn't set out to write the novel, actually. This mm-hmm. was a brainstorm, an idea that came up, and it just kind of took over me. You know, mm-hmm. And I just had to write it. It was writing about the power that women have over men and how they go about getting their own way, mm-hmm. and how impotent us guys are at times when confronted with a woman who wants to impose her will on us. So in a way, there's as much amusement and philosophy in this as there is story and intrigue.
Very interesting. So your background as an investment strategist over the years on Wall Street really helped you to shape up the storyline for Provocative.
Yes. You know, because my protagonist, mm-hmm. Nadia, is the lead character here, takes on powerful men, and that takes us into the financial world, mm-hmm. a territory that I know very well.
Well, give us a synopsis of the book.
Okay. Well, it really is a story about, you know, the power that mm-hmm. women have over men. And it's a story of Nadia, a young Russian woman born in an industrial city in Russia, born out of wedlock, lives her whole young life as an orphan. And if you know anything about Russian orphanages, they're just terrible places. Her early life is one of poverty and despair, oppression in the orphanage. She has no exposure to affection, a behavior trait that she kind of struggles with all through this story, you know, starts to become mm-hmm. attached to, but, you know, it's a struggle for her. But she has some assets, and one of her assets is that she is extremely gifted from a mental standpoint. In fact, she's smarter than any man she comes in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
She comes to America through a Russian mail-order bride program, And in America meets Olga, who was actually behind the mail order bride program. Now, Olga is a very interesting character. She is ex-CIA during the Cold War period, and has led a very adventurous, dangerous life herself, retired from the CIA, and runs an agency in West L.A. that extracts large amounts of money out of wealthy men. Olga does this not so much for the economic thing, but for the sport of it, because she has a big need for action in her life since she left the CIA. So Nadia becomes an agent in Olga's organization. And from there, we follow Nadia through a set of three distinct sting operations. Each one is a bigger, more complex, and more dangerous sort of target. Obviously, these are alpha males, you know, men that are at the top of the species that she has to succeed using, you know, her female ways and prowess to accomplish her mission.
It's a wonderful story. I thought it's got all the mysteries, the intrigue, and that's a lot of personality in each and every one of the character. It's just a wonderful read overall. What made you choose the various characters in the book?
Well, it just kind of evolved linearly. I created them as I went along. I would sometimes find challenging situations where I'd have to figure out a way to get Nadia out of a jam or something. But one of the more interesting characters is Olga, the grand dame of this thing. And the way that got started is August of last year, when I started writing this, I read an obituary of a real live OSS agent. Her name is Nancy Wake. This was in The Economist in August of last year, and Nancy Wake had been a OSS British agent during World War II and lived a very dangerous life behind enemy lines. She passed away at age 98. I actually put it that obituary on my website. It is a fascinating read. What a terrific woman she was. But you know, for any of your listeners that want to check that out on the website, it's provocateurbook.com is the website. Don't go to Provocateur. That's a ladies' lingerie site. It's provocateurbook.com.
That's wonderful. So you did a lot of research before you wrote this book. It is fiction, but at the same time, there are a lot of factual stuff in it as well. So how much research did you do before writing the book?
Well, the research really kind of came along as it evolved. As I mentioned before, I didn't really at the outset set out to write a novel. It just started going and took on a life of its own. So it grew linearly. The story grew linearly, and so there were moments in it when I did have to do some research. And those moments were, I know one of them was when Nadia was going up against the Russian oligarch who was trying to pull off a cyber attack on the U.S. Treasury auction. So that's all automated now, so I really had to dig in and see how would you actually pull that off if you were going to do it, because as you know, any novel, even fiction, has to have total credibility when you're writing it. So I had to do some research, even with my background in technology and finance. You know, it's a pretty complicated subject.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you covered in the book is about the sort of a, what I consider the everyday life as people travel around the world, I guess in this case the CEOs and so forth. And the thing that I was looking at is that how much of all these are facts and how much of it is fiction?
Mm-hmm. Well, the one of my testimonials is from best-selling author Harvey Karp. And when he made his testimonial, he said, you know, perhaps the thing about women's powers is all fact, not fiction. but in the stories, the background in the stories are all backdrop is all factual in nature. So, you know, the places we take to, the issues we deal with, all that is.
You've been in the financial industry for a very long time, and of course, it was much different when you first started out, say, till maybe even the 80s, 90s, and now in the 21st century. The term that's always came up over the years, of course, when it relates to women, the gender differentiation, so to speak, the glass ceiling and so forth. Have mm-hmm. you seen a tremendous change from that standpoint of view?
Absolutely, I have, and I think that we live in a different world, and I do not think there is a glass ceiling now. I think women in business are embraced. I'm not talking about physically, but I think their skills are very much appreciated and welcomed, and I think most business leaders really welcome really talented women, and they can move up the chain of command without any prejudice against them.
How about having to be a type A yourself, woman, mm-hmm. to succeed? Would that be part of the criteria, so to speak?
Well, perhaps they have to have some of the kind of male attributes in terms of certainly drive and discipline and focus and willing to work hard and which women do, but they are often doing it, you know, many in a more homemaking session and there are a lot of sacrifices that women have to do to be in the work environment because, you know, men in that environment work very long hours, and there's sacrifices in your personal life, and women being more sensitive and having, you know, different value set towards family, you know, it's a bigger sacrifice for them, I think.
One of the things you mentioned also in your books under dedication, obviously your wife has been a staunch supporter of what you've done, and I'm sure she's been there for you. So the old adage about behind every successful man, there's a stronger woman behind that man.
mm-hmm. Well, I also comment in that she is the one person that gives me no holds barred criticism. I mean, she is not embarrassed to tell me when I've got something wrong. So
that's wonderful because you have this tremendous amount of insight, I guess, over the years in terms of realizing what women had to offer in terms of making things much, much better. And when you talk about the power of women in a different way, obviously this is a fictional approach to things. But as you had mentioned before, the world has changed tremendously, and certainly in the business world.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So how much of you is actually in the book?
Well, I don't think there's really any of me in the book except for my imagination and my perspective on, you know, the contest between men and women.
What is the most difficult thing for you to write about in Provocateur?
Well, I guess the most difficult thing was the sex scenes. There, when I originally wrote it, I wrote 61 drafts and doing this and put them out to friends to read and review and get feedback. And I clearly remember, you know, I, when I would, in terms of this sex scenes, the more spicy elements in here,
yeah,
I would always kind of suggest that something happened and skip over it and move on.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the women reviewers sent me the draft back, and she had red marks all over it. She says, "What happened that night? I want details." And you know, for me, it was kind of an uneasy thing because I've never read a spicy novel, or I don't know how novelists handle those situations. But, you know, I was a single man until I was 42 years old. So I you know, have known my way around women. But, and I didn't want it to be like a soap opera. I wanted something very interesting to be going on between the male and female when these sexual encounters take place. So I think it actually came off very well, but it was I had a lot of apprehensions about doing it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Provocative, of course, followed a very strong, intelligent, and independent female character, your lead character, Nadia. Was it a challenge for you to write about Nadia from a male perspective?
Not really. It was just great fun. I think for a long time in my life, I've been very attracted to and fascinated with very intelligent women. In a way, I find them, you know, quite sexy. And and so it was, you know, it's something that's gone through my mind for a long time. And I've encountered many very intelligent women in the course of my career, and so I really enjoyed writing about it.
In your dealings in Wall Street, did you ever encounter someone of that nature, like Nadia, so to speak?
You know, I've encountered many very, very bright, audacious, you know, ambitious women. Nadia is a bit of even hyperbole, though. I take her into a very extreme zone of intelligence. So in a way, even there is exaggeration. I look at the contest between men and women with a bit of exaggeration on both sides. I mean, Nadia comes out of this, you know, life of desperation, and she has to face up against some of the most powerful men in the world. So, you know, it's a contest that goes on in everyday life at all levels. But in the novel, we've exaggerated the characters a little bit on both ends.
You're right when you talk about in everyday life. I mean, men, women are equipped for survival from that standpoint of view. So we each pursue that level of wanting to survive. You mentioned about orphanage, and that's one of the things that I think also fascinates me. Not many people talk about that, about orphanages overseas, but in some ways you cover it very well because you have the help of a friend that went through the whole process. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'd mention two points. One is my wife Twyla and I have a niece and her husband that we're having difficulty having children, and we actually sponsored them to do a adoption from a Russian orphanage. They have a wonderful young son that was, you know, Russian, so he's blonde, blue-eyed kid. But with some of the behavioral problems, because the children born there as infants, they're handled by Russian nurses. They get no affection at all, and so it created some challenges in raising him. But on the point, other point you raised, one of the sister of one of the young men that works for me was on a church mission to Russia for 3 weeks, going through orphanages there. And she came back and gave me a very detailed account of just how bad the situation is for those young people that are in the Russian orphanages. The government just siphons off any money, and it's very corrupt. And the children have to live under, you know, just awful conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good, you know, backgrounder for Nadia, and it is fact, not fiction.
Right, right. And people don't realize that too, because what we don't hear, we're obviously not paying attention to.
Mm-hmm. Also on my website, there's a tab you can go down and you can learn about the situation on Russian orphanages. It's the website is very rich in background information, mm-hmm. about the book and the issues which are faced there.
It's very well done. As a matter of fact, I like the comparison between Bonn and Nadia.
That was really a lot of fun doing that. So, you know, if you want, I'll kind of run down it for your
audience.
Go
ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So one of the things we did, you know, some people have compared Nadia to James Bond. And in fact, with the book, we want her to have a life that goes on beyond this book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So on the website, there's a little chart, and the chart has a picture of a James Bond, old James Bond, at the top of it, and has one of an actress at the top of the other one. And the comparison goes, James Bond was British and male, Nadia Borodin was Russian and female. His favorite drink was a dry martini, shaken, not stirred. Hers was Cordon Charlemagne, slightly chilled. His automobile was a gray Aston Martin. Hers is a yellow Lamborghini. Now, the yellow Lamborghini is not in the book, but it is in the movie. His wardrobe was a pinstripe suit. Hers was a black silk dress. His villain was Goldfinger. Hers was Vladimir Russov, the Russian oligarch. His game of skill was poker. Hers was poker. Maybe they should play each other. His weapon of choice is a .45 caliber handgun. Her weapon of choice is her brains and her body. His love interest was dangerous, beautiful women. Hers, no man was her match. So I kind of go through that.
It's wonderful. I thought when I got to that section of your website, it was a wonderful comparison. And I actually love James Bond. Ever since I was a kid, I watched all the old James Bond movies and, of course, carried forward to, you know, what it is right now. I know that my dad was really fond of Sean Connery as being the best Bond.
Well, Sean Connery is the image at the top of that comparison
right.
on the site.
That's wonderful. The suspense, cleverness, and the sexual tensions from Provocateur obviously has been compared to movies like The Thomas Crown Affair, which I really love, and Body Heat. Did these movies play a role in terms of influencing the book at all?
Yes, very definitely they did. And Thomas Crown Affair was great for the intrigue and the storyline, but at the end the guy gets the comes out on top. In Body Heat it's the other way around, so I think Body Heat was much more influential. I loved, you know, Kathleen Turner plays the role of this very superior woman. William Hurt is this average guy that gets swept up into her web. He doesn't know what hit him. He's just completely outclassed. But the movie goes on. It doesn't let you know that until you get towards the end. But it is clearly a part of what is one of the great movies of all time, I think.
You mentioned briefly just now a little bit about Nadia's yellow Lamborghini will be in the movie. So I presume that there is a movie in the making for Provocateur?
Yes. Actually, we just completed the screenplay last week. The screenplay was written by David Ward, who is an Academy Award-winning screenwriter. He's he's done at least 15 movies and has been in the business for a long time. He got his first Academy Award when he was a young man. He wrote The Sting. Got nominated for Sleepless in Seattle, and he's just done. You'd recognize all the names of the movies that he has read. But David is terrific and did a really good job on it. So we're just now starting talks with producers and studios and directors to see if we can get the movie made on this thing.
Congratulations. That must be a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. That's fun. I mean, this is a whole different... Obviously, the entertainment industry is a very unusual industry, and I've dealt with all kinds of businesses in my life. I've served on the board of directors of 42 different companies, public and private, and but this entertainment business is very convoluted. It's a very different business.
And I think also, I mean, in this case, being that it is your personal pet project, it's a little bit personal. For me personally, it's difficult for me to kind of push it in some ways. You have to have somebody else do it.
Yes, true.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Provocateur?
I think Provocateur is mostly entertainment. Perhaps there's some amusement. There's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek of putting a man against a woman and that age-old, replaying an age-old theme. But, hopefully they will learn a few things along the way, learn about the America's Cup, about, cybersecurity issues, about Russian orphanages, about some very, we take the reader to some very interesting places, and like Costa Smeralda on Sardinia and many other places, and big yachts and things which most people don't have the opportunity to experience. So we take them into a pretty high life world that hopefully they can enjoy the process too.
Very interesting. Your book also mentioned about what I consider as high-end crime, and then you got the low-end crime.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, I don't know, I guess in some ways, under normal circumstances, you hear about the low-end crime more often in the reports and so forth on TV and elsewhere. But it's fascinating to know that crime exists at all levels of society. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think in the last major sting there, the theme surrounds a cybercrime. And in that, this is where Nadia goes up against this Russian oligarch. And, the oligarch has a small team, and he wants to use a cyber attack on the U.S. Treasury auction to pull off a heist of getting $1 billion out of the U.S. Treasury auction without the U.S. government knowing that it was gone, which I don't think they would know it was gone anyway in these days. But, we really have to deal with the emerging threat that I think the U.S. and other developed nations worldwide face about cyber warfare and cyber crime, which is a pretty big deal. And over the next decade or two, it may be the biggest threat that our country faces. We saw a little bit of it in that it can be a weapon also. A couple of years ago, Iran's nuclear centrifuge facility was attacked, and no one knows whether it was Israel or the U.S., but they were able to go in there with internet worms and cause the Iran's nuclear centrifuges to accelerate completely out of control and destroy themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a little preview of the kind of thing that can happen as we move into this next decade or two.
Very interesting stuff. Are we prepared for that, do you think, from a financial perspective?
Well, I think preparedness comes, you know, we are not prepared from a financial perspective, but our government has a unit, and it's featured mm-hmm. in the book, which tells about this unit, which only got started like a year or two ago, mm-hmm. to focus on cyber warfare activities and how to prevent them, how to block it, how to use it. So, you know, our government knows that this is a very serious issue. And the same is true in Great Britain and mm-hmm. in Germany and in a number of other developed countries where they are developing these cyber warfare units, mostly for defense, but somewhat for offense. But in many other rogue nations, they're looking at it as a attack mechanism. So this is serious business.
When it becomes a state-sponsored cyber attack, the dynamics change, obviously.
Yes, yes. But, you know, it doesn't have to be state-sponsored. I mean, a couple of really good techies that are a rogue unit can be a very potent insurgency. I mean, mm-hmm. That's one of the things that makes it very difficult.
Mm-hmm. In defense of such an attack, does the American companies themselves have to take their own actions in terms of self-defense?
Yes.
They can't rely on the government
to do that. Yeah. And in fact, many of them, you know, especially the big financial institutions have organizations that are dealing with that every day.
Very interesting. Coming back to your book, mm-hmm. how has writing Provocative impacted you personally?
Oh, it's like a whole new chapter in my life. I mean, my life has been, you know, doing serious stuff and running companies, investing in companies, sophisticated investment strategy, mm-hmm. All that global stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never thought about, you know, fiction, but writing fiction is really great fun. It's wonderful. It uses one's imagination, and I love it. It's opened up a whole new chapter in my life.
Very interesting. Were any of your families growing up, were they sort of involved with having the skill of writing and so forth? Did you follow anyone in the family from that standpoint of view?
No. You know, my family, as I said earlier, is very poor. None of them ever went to college, actually. My father was a maintenance man at a small post office in Ohio, and mm-hmm. my mom worked as a clerk in the dry cleaning store. And, you know, my beginnings were really very modest. I had no role models.
You're basically self-made, so that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, the website is just a great source of the information. Mm-hmm. Again, that's provocateurbook.com. But the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's available in ebook form. Mm-hmm. Its print versions are available in hardcover and paperback. The hardcover is really a beautiful book. I mean, I put extra mm-hmm. money into really making it a beautiful end product. There is an image on the inside, and the inside, if you open the cover of most books, the first thing is blank pages, which are mm-hmm. just basically white. Mm-hmm. There's a Japanese artist that did this intriguing image of a man's legs going one way and a woman's going the other, It's kind of like a black and white mirror image sort of thing, and we ghosted that back to being subtle, and we used that as the interior to that. And then the cover is just great. So I think it's a really nice physical product in addition to having some worthwhile things to read inside.
I really like the cover, as a matter of fact, but the one I got, it's only, of course, the advanced copy, but I love the cover. Who did the cover for you guys?
A lady by the name of Patricia Bacall in L.A. was my designer, and she was terrific. If you just have the art copy, I ought to send you a hardback copy. So it's a beautiful book and would be a nice keepsake for you.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Thank you very much for offering to do that, because it's just a wonderful book. I love it. When I first got that in the mail, I said, okay, cool. This is something that I really want to talk about.
And it's getting some good reports from readers. It's on Goodreads. You know, Goodreads.com is, you probably know, a principal site for people who read books. And there are 19 million unique visitors every month to that site. And Provocateur is carrying a 4.8 out of their 5-star rating. It's one of the highest rated books there.
That's wonderful. That's really great. So what's next for you?
Well, right now I've started writing the sequel. It will continue the saga between Nadia and Olga and some other characters in the book. I think we're going to see the Russian oligarch Vladimir Russov coming back into the picture. I mean, he's probably not real happy letting a woman get the best of him, so he's got to find this damn Nadia some wherever she is. My ambition for it is that she will continue through a series of books, kind of like the James Bond was to me, and these are not monumental 500, 600, 700 page novels. These are like 220, 230, 230 pages. And so they're an easy read, like the James Bond novels. The James Bond novels were just like 165 to 220 pages. And so they were very easy, quick read. They didn't have all the fluff and description and everything, which for some readers is, you know, they try and find a way to skip over that and get back to the story. This is 100% story.
Well, what I like about it, I think also it gives you an opportunity to kind of walk through the period of time from the ages in terms of when we talk about men and women, the natural challenge, the competition, the contest, one over you kind of thing. And I thought that was very interesting. And now it becomes whereby we are living in a generation where it's almost equal in everything that we do. And so that's just wonderful, because you have the sort of a generation transition between the old, the new, and the future in some ways. Having said that, what advice do you have for men and women who are caught up in the Battle of the Sexes contest?
Well, good question. I think growing an appreciation for the contest and to understand the differences between the two genders and how each of the sexes seek to have their way with the other. I mean, that's one of the things, you know. One of the readers said, "Oh, man, Charles, you're a woman's liber." I said, "No. It's really not about strong women taking on men's attributes. It's about celebrating the differences between the sexes and how they operate and how they seek to get their way with the opposite gender."
And of course, using their own natural strength.
Yes. You know, men and women have different assets and have different ways of thinking and behaving. And so That's the great fun of this.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of times that's kind of lost in translation in so many ways. But I like the fact that in reading the information that's on your website, and you talk about since the beginning of time how women are using their assets for the greater good rather than the greater bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's fascinating about the Spartans and the war where the women protest and not, you know, wanting to have sex with their mates.
Mm-hmm.
And the technique obviously has been used over and over again by African women in Africa. I believe in Sudan and other places where the women are just sick and tired about the male throwing their egos all over the place.
Well, there's an interesting story in America, too. In the Pennsylvania area, there were, ages ago, there were two different Indian tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And these Indian tribes were constantly at war with each other.
Right.
And there seemed to be no resolution, no way to bring peace there. And they decided, each tribe elected a woman to be the chief of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And they stopped fighting.
Again, you're injecting a different sort of a take on things, because we have men, we have all our testosterone flying all over the place out there. Women comes in from a very different perspective. And of course, I mean, I write about the power of unconditional love and how you could use that and still attain whatever you want to attain, but in a very different way versus being fear driven, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's one of the things that I enjoy about reading Provocateur, in the sense that, okay, this is very interesting because it highlights the power of women from a totally different perspective.
Yes.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Before that, there was one thing that you had asked about thoughts on. There's an interesting aspect of this book, too, that I'd like to mention,
which is
there is no real bright line between hero, heroine, and villain, as there are in most books. If you look at some of the popular ones, Hunger Games and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, you know who the heroine is, and you know who the villain is. They're painted black and white. And here there's no bright line between them. I mean, my heroine is not a Snow White character. She's and her victims are really not bad guys. I mean, a little bit. But so these characters are not as melodramatic as they are in most books. They're more real, more granular. So I'd just like to add that point going on. So, recipe for living, that was your question?
Yes.
Well, I guess as a man who's had the good fortune to live a very big, robust life with a lot of variety in it, I guess my view is that life is kind of a smorgasbord of wonderful and varied opportunities. And if there's any advice I have, it's to not be afraid to take the road less traveled. Not be afraid to do interesting new things. Many people kind of get stuck in the momentum that life sweeps them into, and it's a big life out there, and don't waste a minute of it, I guess is my thought.
Wonderful. What were some of the memorable experiences you have encountered over the years in terms of just applying your recipe for living life?
That is a really good question. I think it's, in my life, there have been many times when I ended up taking the road less traveled. I mean, when I was a young man, just out of college, I'd worked for Hughes, and I was confronted with an opportunity to do a startup high-tech company. And I wasn't an entrepreneur. I knew nothing about running companies or getting them financed and all that. But, you know, I thought, what the hell? I'll give it a whirl. Mm-hmm. And I did, and it really was a change agent in my life. It took my life on a totally different path. And when I look at life, we have a series of choices. You know, we see you know, a familiar way to go, and we see kind of an adventuring way that might offer something new but has risk associated with it. And you know, I've always kind of taken the more adventuring one, and I've been very fortunate not to fall in a pothole doing it. But you know, I think all of us in life are confronted with choices, and a big thing is to get off your duff on a couch and go do it.
Looking back, were there any what if moments at all?
I think that you know, I think about a lot of what ifs that could have taken me the wrong direction. I mean, going way back to time I was in college, I was working 45 hours a week and carrying huge academic load, I didn't have much of a social life. But towards the end of my college career, there was a very attractive gal that was on my case and was interested in me, and I was afraid of women back then. I didn't know what to do with them. And I think, you know, if I had been more socialized and like, I might have married her and stayed in Ohio and lived in a little town with a white picket fence, and my life would have been totally different. So, you know, there are so many of those when I look back at occasions when my life could have steered in another way, and I've ended up with a fabulous life. But you know, there were many, many forks in a road where it could have led a different direction, and I think that's part of the human experience. I mean, we all do, and sometimes the road leads to the wrong place, but that's part of the human experience.
One of the fascinating things about the fact that you mentioned how old you are, you're 75 years young, and obviously, certainly, the best years are still ahead of you. That's how I look at it.
Well, that's a great comment. I am very, very fortunate to be in excellent health. I mean, you know, my doctors look at me and they say, geez, you know, you're chronologically, you're 75, but you look like you're 50. And here I am with, you know, being fortunate to have, you know, total freedom on what I do with my time, which is a benefit of reaching some affluence. The the venture capital firm and leverage buyout firm were extremely good to me financially. So then you enter a period of life where you have these resources and you can do whatever you want to do. And for me, it's not doing golf. I mean, it's a great responsibility to have the power and flexibility to use your time to the best that you can. And it's a huge responsibility and a challenge to think, what can I do that has the greatest impact on my fellow man and society? And so that occupies a great deal of my mental energy.
That's wonderful, because I do see and feel in talking with you on the air this morning, you're a very passionate person about the things you have done, and obviously you've accomplished a lot. And I mean that when I say the best years are still ahead of you, because you are not stopping. And that doesn't mean that we don't stop smell the roses now, but the fact that there's a purpose.
I'm more energized now than I've ever been in my life.
That's wonderful. That's fascinating.
Yeah. My wife says, you know, Chuck, you know, if I put you on an iceberg in the middle of the ocean, you'd find something interesting to do.
That's a wonderful compliment. That's fascinating. You are living what you want to live now. which is the way you want to live. And you are really making an impact not only for yourself, but everyone around you and the world in so many ways, in the things that you talk about and the work that you do. And in the form of entertainment, I mean, the book is obviously is a fiction, no doubt about it. But at the same time, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. And that's the interesting part about having books like yours out there, where it's just not purely just entertainment, because there's some innate value to be received in reading those kind of books.
Yes.
So it's wonderful. Well, Charles, thank you again for the great recipe for living that you had mentioned to us just now. And that's just wonderful, the way you live your life according to the recipe of living that you've shared with us and spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be acclaimed Southern writer Michael Morris. Michael and I will be discussing his latest novel titled Man in the Blue Moon. The book uses the oral history his grandfather had passed along to him about the turn of the century Florida during World War I. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Charles, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.